It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs wants to enlist 1 million veterans to take part in a national research initiative that hopes to learn how genetics inform illness common to people who've served in combat and in the military. Bea Chakraborty is the research coordinator in the Pittsburgh VA office. Bea, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you, Gavin.
Nationwide, some 800,000 veterans have signed up for the Million Veteran Program. It's about capturing DNA data through blood draws. What do you and other VA leaders want to do with that information?
Actually, the goal of the MVP program is to learn more about how genes affect our health and how we can improve health, in the future for veterans and the entire population.
So is it about treatment, prevention? What else are you hoping to learn about and address through this data as you study it?
Better treatment, of course. More, maybe even cures. Imagine finding a cure for cancer through this particular type of DNA research.
Are there particular conditions, illnesses, that whether they are more prevalent among veterans, more prevalent among military, or even the general population, that you really want to focus in on?
Some of the things that we are looking to focus in on, Kevin, is actually cancer, heart disease, diabetes, PTSD, breast cancer. Some of those are the leading illnesses, I guess. Even things as, although it's not simple, something like hypertension.
Right. Well, a lot of those are common to the general population.
Absolutely.
Do we know at this point, if veterans are more susceptible to any of those, whether it's hypertension or cancer?
It appears that veterans might be more susceptible to diabetes. And that's just speculation. We have no conclusive evidence yet, but that's one of them. PTSD, of course, one of the leading illnesses is suicide.
Right.
And we're trying to do everything possible to prevent suicide. And there is genetic connection between your genes, of course, and suicide.
Right. And, of course, we have learned that approximately, the numbers change a bit, approximately 20 veterans a day commit suicide.
That has not changed in years. In fact, it might even be getting to be more.
What's special about the 1 million number? There are an estimated 20 million veterans living in the U.S. Why do you need so many?
The more information you have, the better research you conduct, and the more you add to your validity of when you announce that, for instance, there's a genetic connection to breast cancer, and it's only 10,000 women. We may not listen as much as if we found a genetic connection between breast cancer and the woman's genes, and we've done that for 900,000 people. That's something I might sit back and listen to. Smoking since a cessation would be something similar. If you have, you can prove that smoking is genetic in 10,000 people. Well, you might listen because 10,000 is a smaller number. But when you get to a million, you have more validity in your research.
Are you looking for veterans of all eras, World War II to present, or what?
Every era, from 18 to 102, 103. So we're looking at World War II, Korean, Vietnam veterans, Afghanistan, Gulf War, you name it.
What sort of participation, World War II veterans versus, you know, others who have served at different eras, are you getting? Is it one that's more agreeable to participate?
The preponderance of veterans right now are Vietnam veterans. And the Vietnam veterans, I guess it's the area because it's Pittsburgh. We have a lot more Vietnam veterans in this area than we have in others. But
No, go ahead.
No, I was just thinking that the Vietnam veterans outweigh the others. We have research on our, we have research information on our website to confirm some of those, you know, to confirm the numbers.
Right. Now, you are looking for, you know, a million veterans, but not strictly those who served in combat. You're also seeking veterans who were not in war zones. And what would that tell you?
Well, we need to make comparisons. So if you have veterans who have been in a combat era, and you have veterans who have not been in combat eras, if you have someone with a particular illness and you want to explain how one person gets that illness and another one doesn't, you need the comparison. So we need veterans who don't have combat experience as well.
Mentioned 800,000 have signed up so far, taken part. What about from the Pittsburgh region, your region? What's been the response in trying to coax veterans from our region to get involved?
We've had a pretty good response. Right now, we're a little bit over 14,000 veterans have been recruited from the Western Pennsylvania. That includes Erie, Altoona, Butler, Pittsburgh, and Southern Ohio. These, maybe not Southern Ohio, but Ohio.
I gotcha.
And those 14,000, that's not an easy number to get to, even though we have a lot of veterans in this area. We've had to go out and reach them in their in the rural areas.
Yeah, so how do you do that? What is the outreach process to find and ask them to participate?
It's pretty interesting here. We've engaged the either the vet center, the VA vet center, or we have the VA bus, which is a FEMA outfitted bus, to take us. My group, my team goes out to different community-based outpatient clinics. And we also go to other outreach events that are generally at military bases.
Right.
And we take the bus out. Our bus is fully equipped
To do the blood draws?
To do the blood draw and to do the, we carry our laptops with us. So the bus is outfitted. It's, you know, for it generates energy for us.
Right.
We also have, I don't want to say refrigerator on board. And
to preserve.
Yeah, to preserve the blood. And we have, we can do our enrollment right on the bus. We do not have to go into the facility and disrupt the workday or the workflow of the centers where we're going.
I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest on the Confluence is Bea Chakraborty, research coordinator in the VA's Pittsburgh office for the Million Veteran Program. Bea, what can you learn from, say, a Vietnam War veteran that you wouldn't learn from maybe a post 9/11 veteran?
Let's see. Let's start with Agent Orange, maybe.
Right.
The combat veterans, and it's presumed now if you had boots on ground in Vietnam, you were exposed to Agent Orange. I was there, so I kind of know that firsthand.
Right.
And the veterans there were exposed to a toxic environment that maybe post 9/11 veterans were not, but then they had their own problems being exposed to burn pits, toxic waters in Camp Lejeune. So there's been a lot of course, that wasn't post 9/11, but those are the differences that you might get from the veterans.
Your relationship with the military and to those who served, as you mentioned, goes back to Vietnam. Why is this research important to you?
Ooh, that's a good question. It's important to me because I want to help future veterans, and I want to help other veterans, and that's part of who we are, veterans helping veterans, and that's what the MVP program is about.
So many medical studies struggle to get sample sizes that match the demographic makeup of the group that they're studying. Of that 800,000 already on board, do you have enough women, enough people of color, people of all ages and with diverse experiences?
Good. The women. We, even with 800,000 people, we have less than, we have about 9% of those are women veterans. And that's, we don't know what the problem is or why women aren't coming forth, but the research can only be as good as the demographics that you put into it. So we do need more women to participate.
And women who served, I believe, was the fastest growing veteran population.
Absolutely.
So what do you feel, what do some feel is a greater reluctance to participate? What when somebody says no to you, why are they saying no?
Many reasons. One of the reasons is they don't trust the government. They don't trust, or they've had bad experiences, and they're basing their no on that. Others haven't listened to the entire reason why we need them to participate, and they don't know how important they really are. So I think that might be another reason why they would not sign up.
Is it also, it's their own personal information and they don't want to share it, in addition to maybe trust a factor?
I do hear that. I don't want to share my DNA with anybody. I hear that a lot.
What about the willingness of post-9/11 veterans? I mean, they're younger, more used to sharing personal data. Does that make sense to them to do this?
We are really light on having the post-9/11 veterans involved. I don't know what the answer is to that, Kevin. I know that they're used to sharing their information on social media,
right.
But maybe they consider DNA just a little bit too close.
A little too close.
Too personal.
Mm-hmm. We have less than a minute left, B. So what is your pitch to a veteran who is reluctant to participate? What do you say to them, and would it benefit them, somebody else?
The pitch is you're used to helping others, and that's what veterans do. And now it's your turn to continue to support veterans and future veterans. And if you don't want to do it in front of me, you can now enroll online. Just go to our website.
And what is that?
www.mvp.va.gov.
And we will have a link to that website on our website, wesa.fm. B. Chakraborty is the research coordinator in the Pittsburgh VA office for the Million Veteran Program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski, still ahead on The Confluence. After calls by the mayor this week for the state to take financial control of Pittsburgh public schools, we'll talk to Superintendent Anthony Hamlet. Then Pennsylvania's Attorney General Josh Shapiro is meeting with other state AGs today to cross the T's and dot the I's of a major opioid settlement. Plus, some PNC customers say the bank isn't playing ball with third-party payment apps like Venmo, and the bank's response has been mixed. You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
The Grateful Dead's 10th studio album, Shakedown Street, was released 41 years ago this week. Was produced by Lowell George of Little Feat. Now, it's often panned as disco dead, but that's not an entirely fair assessment. Many of the songs on the album, including the title track, became staples of the band's live show for years, not to mention the cultural phenomenon of the Shakedown Street itself, a midway-like thoroughfare often found in the parking lots outside of venues where fans could find anything from bootleg t-shirts and patches to grilled cheese and drugs, for better or for worse. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spihar.
A major natural gas pipeline in Pennsylvania has federal investigators looking at possible corruption among state officials. This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Reed Frazier. The Associated Press is reporting the FBI has begun a corruption investigation into how Governor Tom Wolf's administration issued permits for construction of a natural gas pipeline. The Mariner East pipeline carries natural gas liquids. These are often used to make plastic, from western Pennsylvania to an export facility near Philadelphia. So why is the FBI now interested in how the Wolf administration approved it? Here to talk about this is someone who's covered the Mariner East, Susan Phillips of WHYY in Philadelphia and State Impact Pennsylvania. Susan, welcome.
Thanks, Reed.
So, Susan, the AP is reporting from three sources that the FBI is looking at how the permits for this pipeline were issued. Do we know what specifically the FBI is interested in here?
It sounds like the FBI is looking into the role that the Wolf administration played in the permitting of the Mariner East 2 pipeline. The Department of Environmental Protection has the role of looking at the environmental costs and trying to mitigate the environmental damage of any kind of large construction project such as this. But it sounds like, from what this report says, that the people who have been questioned, whether they're current or former employees, the line of questioning has a lot to do with what Governor Wolf's role was and what the role of the administration was.
And they were looking for to see whether anyone in the administration received anything in return for a sort of improper approval.
Right. So it's interesting what they would be looking at. You know, was there a quid pro quo? Was there any state or federal laws that were violated? Of course, this, you know, the permitting process basically comes under the Clean Water Act for the most part. So was that violated in any way? The fact is that a lot of people have been saying for several years now that they suspect that the Wolf administration had pushed forward the permits on the behalf of Sunoco over the objections of perhaps some employees at DEP.
Can you remind us again what these permits were for? And have there been any environmental problems along this pipeline route since they were approved?
So these permits basically permit the company to go through waterways, whether that's drilling underneath a stream bank or a wetland. And what we've seen since these permits were issued has been a slew of drilling mud spills, sinkholes in Chester County that opened up in people's backyards. And it sort of goes back to what a lot of people who oppose this pipeline will say is, hey, we've been warning about this all along. And once the construction started, what we were saying has come true. But there's also the issue of, did the Wolf administration push for these permits to get approved, you know, in a fast-tracked way that may have prevented environmental oversight that was needed to prevent these problems that have since happened? And of course, the Wolf administration denies that. They say that that's not the case, that they listened and made sure that the employees at the Department of Environmental Protection were able to do their jobs.
Susan Phillips is a reporter for WHYY and State Impact Pennsylvania. To see more of Susan's reporting, go to AlleghenyFront.org. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Reed Frazier.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. At a budget address on Tuesday, Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto said he thinks the Pittsburgh Public Schools should hand over financial control to the state. The district operates independently from the city, and the mayor does not have a say in state oversight. The district, for its part, has said it wants tax revenue back that was diverted to city government for 15 years when the city itself was in financial trouble. Pittsburgh Public Schools Superintendent Anthony Hamlet joins us now. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you for having us. Appreciate it.
The mayor said Tuesday that he wants to discuss with you the district's financial position. What's your message to him?
Absolutely. We've already reached out to the mayor's office. We want to set up a meeting to have a conversation and see what the possibilities are.
How do you feel like the district is doing in terms of its financial position?
I think the district is doing well in its financial position, but we need to revisit some things and make sure that we're always being fiscally prudent with taxpayer dollars. So we want to look at it internally and externally and see what we can do to better our position.
In the past decade, PPS has used money from its reserves to balance that budget. It's closed several school buildings, but it's not yet on the state's watch list. How would you describe the next steps for the district?
Well, right now, we're not working with the state. We're just internally looking at our books. And at a certain point, again, we want to look at all options. And that's what we did the other day when we did our presentation on the budget. The proposed budget. So make this very clear. It's proposed budget. So and part of it is my job is to make sure that I give the board, my board, as much information as they need to make a sound decision. And so basically that's what we did. We gave them four options and showed them the possibilities of what could happen based on those options.
What are those four options?
One, no raise in tax, what that would mean. Next, a raise in tax. And then also the option of the earned income tax credits that are being diverted to the city and what that would look like if we have those dollars back in our coffers. So.
And number four?
Multiple tax increases. That's what it was over time. And that's something that we wouldn't do, bank it in, but just giving a long-term outlook of what it would be.
The board is set to vote on that proposed budget in December. As you say, one of those could include a bump in property taxes. That would be the first time that the district has raised those in 5 years. Why do you feel like now could be the right time for that?
Looking at where we are right now with our fund balance, but also where we are with our operating budget. So it seems like a good time to do that at this point. But also internally, over the last year, year and a half, I've commissioned my chief financial officer, Ron Joseph, to do a 10% reduction in every department, in every division. And the model that reduction to see what that will look like. Again, making sure that we're not saying we're not doing a reduction in force. We're not looking at that. We just want to see if we had to do a 10% cutback in all departments, what that will look like. So we model that already.
And all departments, that can mean a lot of things, right?
So at a district office.
District office.
Okay. Very clear on that.
Do you want the city to include a payment to the school district in this year's budget as a form of compensation?
No, we don't have anything in mind right now. We just want to tee up a conversation with the mayor, with the city, and think about the possibilities over time. And I want to make sure everybody understands we're not asking for any money back. We're just saying this is what our financial outlook is. However, with the money that's being diverted, about $20 million a year, this is how we will look as far as our fund balance and our operating budget.
The district is also taking on a reimagining. A 300-page report introduced to board members last week projected continued declines in enrollment for some schools. In total, the district, it said, was down 17% over the last 10 years, although some schools, it notes, are actually growing. Board President Linda Wren said at a meeting that, as it's laid out, the district is spread too thin. Do you agree?
Yes, we have a decline in enrollment, but we have to realize we have the birth rate is going down in the city as well. A lot of parents are being priced out of the market because of rising property taxes, so they're leaving the city. So we have to look at that from all sides and not just say they're leaving Pittsburgh Public Schools. We still have 65% of the market when it comes to public education students.
Do you feel like that means with 65%, you have room to grow to get students back into the fold?
Absolutely. And that's something that we're looking at. I don't want to compete against charters. I want to make sure that we have the best product for our students.
Best product. Do you feel like you have that right now?
Absolutely. No comparison.
How so?
Well, we have CTE programs. Mm-hmm. If you look at charter schools, they very rarely have CTE programs, if at all. We have advanced placed coursework, IB programs. We have, that's International Baccalaureate. We have AP advanced placement courses. We have our CAS program, and that's honors courses as well for our gifted and talented students. But also the plethora of magnet programs that we have in our schools as well.
Do you think that every student at Pittsburgh Public receives the same education?
I would say right now, no. Mm-hmm. Right now, no, we're at different levels. But one of the things that we're doing and that's clear in our mission, in our vision that we have written down in a lot of our plans is that we want to make sure that anywhere you go, irregardless of zip code, you will have the same quality education. So we're looking at all of our schools right now, the racial disparity when it comes to kids and their opportunities, but also poverty. You know, some kids come with, exposure they've had, and that makes a difference. And so one of the things we're also focusing on, if we really want to make a dent or eradicate this achievement gap, we have to start from birth. That's where it begins. That's where the achievement gap happens, from birth to pre-K or birth to kindergarten. If your kids aren't getting that intellectual stimulation they need to have to grow and learn and be ready for pre-K or kindergarten, then that's the cause and that's the problem. However, traditionally, we are only funded pre-K some, but also kindergarten and 12th grade. So how do we reach out to our partners, our foundation partners, our private business partners, our community, our city, and come up with programs to make sure we address this problem and really eradicate that? If we're serious about it, let's get together as a city and say, hey, we have about 5,000 kids that are not getting what they need to have. What kind of programs can we put in place to make sure that they get the intellectual stimulation they need to be ready and prepared for school?
Do you feel like you have the beginnings of those financial partnerships now?
Yes.
What do they want to see from you to make that next step, to cut that big check that could really make a difference for Pittsburgh Public School students?
They really want to see the vision, the plan, and action. And they've seen over time right now with our strategic plan that we've laid out that we are about getting things done. We're not just about saying and putting out this fluff, but we're actually getting things done and being transparent about it as well.
Part of that strategic plan, of course, that reimagining, that 300-page report. Board mm-hmm. President Wren told my WESA colleague Sarah Schneider that even a tax increase might just kick the can down the road a little bit. Do you imagine that this could mean, again, very beginning of the process, that more school buildings could close in the next few years?
I would say anything's possible. But one of the things you want to make sure that whatever happens moving forward, we will increase our opportunities for our students, our educational programming will get better as a result, and we will be innovative and creative and support our students to make sure they have a high quality education.
Could this mean redistricting, changing the feeder pattern for the district's 24,000
kids?
Yes, we actually did a
demographic study. So be very clear, it's not a feeder pattern study. It's a demographic study to find out our traffic of our students and their enrollment. But also that would help us understand and go into looking at feeder patterns as well.
I'm Megan Harris. Our guest on The Confluence is Pittsburgh Public School Superintendent Anthony Hamlett. Dr. Hamlett, at its next meeting, the school board is expected to vote on a new MOU, new agreement with city police. This has a lot to do with what parents and some community activists see as overly punitive measures on students acting out, particularly very young girls and boys of color. The district has already banned suspensions as a punishment for nonviolent infractions for kids ages pre-K to second grade. What more would this agreement with city police do?
One of the things that agreement is doing is looking at how the police access our students while they're on campus or in school. So say, for instance, if the police come and they have an arrest warrant for a student, what interaction would they have? Making sure, and one of the things our board is adamant about as well as administration, you want to make sure that the child has representation, parent representation, wherever possible. And if that doesn't happen, we'll hold back. We want to hold back the police talking to that kid until that student has a parent with them.
Some parents say that the suspension ban should extend to fifth graders all the way up. What are your thoughts on that?
That might be a possibility, because I would say this. Number one, we don't want any of our students out of school for any reason whatsoever. However, we know when you have violent acts, that may be an issue, but also knowing that just suspending kids is not the answer as well. So we want to make sure we put resources and programs in place to support kids. Kids come with a lot of baggage from home, from the community, things of that nature as well. So we want to make sure we're able to support those students, but also support our teachers and helping them manage those behaviors as well in the classroom. But also, again, looking at mental health supports, trauma-informed care, social-emotional learning to help kids cope with their emotional behavior.
For ages 3, ages 6, ages 9, what does violence mean?
Hitting, scratching, biting, being aggressive. So it could be, you know, various different things.
Some parents have also asked that students with disabilities be exempted from suspension, that better services could be put in place for those kids. Is that something that the district has the resources to provide?
We're looking at that right now, and that's part of our Imagine Pittsburgh PPS, looking at our funding model and our allocation model for special education.
I want to turn to a report released this week by A-plus Schools. It highlighted six schools that it says are performing better than the district as a whole. What do you think is going right at some of these schools that maybe isn't happening at others?
I would say, again, let's look at population demographics. Not saying that's a hindrance, but those are factors that contribute to kids in the achievement gap. You know, you have a socioeconomic status of middle to upper middle class parents going there. So you look at a different demographic and different preparation of students when they come to that school.
What do you feel like those barriers are to achievement, to attendance, to declining enrollment overall?
Motivation. Kids not feeling that they have a way out, that they have clear support, that their interest level is not there. So it's our job to kind of find out why and make sure that our schools are places where kids want to go and they're excited about going.
So a lot of plans, a lot of internal and external studies. What are the next steps for Pittsburgh Public?
You know, it's interesting, right? When we launched our strategic plan, I said now is when the hard work begins. So now we launched our equity plan. Now the hard work begins to make sure it gets done and realized. As we progress monitor, we have it in phases, and we want to make sure that we can embrace the notion of continuous improvement, because, again, it's not just about putting a plan out. We want to actually get these things done. And so we'll be progress monitoring for the next 3 years to make sure everything that we have in that plan is implemented.
And phase one?
And phase one
includes what?
Phase one includes several things. Right now, the first thing we're going to look at is 3G. 3G is a part of our RISE evaluation system that addresses culturally relevant pedagogy and culturally relevant practices. We want to make sure that our administrators and our teachers understand what it means, what those practices are, what we want to see out of 3G in the classroom.
Does that mean taking on maybe cultural bias or implicit bias, things that you or I might have been taught that now that you rethink it as an adult, we don't want to teach our young people?
Absolutely. Those are some of the professional development that we'll be having. And one of the things that we talk about in Pittsburgh Public Schools is that we don't like one-stop shops. You just go to this workshop, go to this professional development, and then is done. We want to make sure that whatever we do, wherever we provide, is connected to our plans that are in place.
Does that mean that Pittsburgh Public might be doing a curriculum review as well? So much of this comes in the form of our textbooks, things that are ingrained in a deeper way than maybe just what we think naturally.
Absolutely. So to your point, right now, I commission an ethnic studies work group right now. So we want to look at our curriculum. We want to make sure kids of color see themselves in the text and the material that they read. Oftentimes, that's not the case. So we want to change that narrative because that has a bearing on how they see themselves, how they achieve in the classroom as well. So to your point, we have an ethnic studies working group that will come up with some recommendations for us moving forward to see how we can implement more culturally relevant content into our curriculum.
Anthony Hamlet is the superintendent of Pittsburgh Public Schools. Dr. Hamlet, thanks so much for making time.
Oh, thank you for having us all the time. Appreciate it.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro will join his counterparts from most other states in Washington today to try to iron out final details of a proposed $48 billion settlement with makers and distributors of prescription opioids. Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporter Rich Lord has been covering these developments, and he's on the line. Good morning, Rich.
Hey, Kevin. How are you?
I am well, sir. Thank you. So what did Josh Shapiro tell you about what he hopes will happen in Washington today?
Well, he's among four attorneys general who are trying to craft this $48 billion settlement with five members of kind of the pharmaceutical community or pharmaceutical industry, which have been involved with either making or distributing opioids. There are a lot of details left to be worked out in terms of this $48 billion proposed settlement. We already know that about $22 billion would be cash and $26 billion would be addiction treatment drugs. But the kind of precise breakdown of what would go to states versus municipalities, what would go to treatment versus what would be more able to be used more flexibly, all that needs to be worked out. Plus, right, there's a whole slew of private attorneys involved whose fees are an issue, too.
Right. There are 2,600 lawsuits, I believe, including from the city of Pittsburgh and Allegheny County against the pharmaceutical companies. Is Shapiro confident the cities and counties will sign off on this deal?
I think he feels that's likely, but he's certainly not there yet. And he needs a preponderance of those cities and counties to agree to this deal in order to make it work. The attorneys for those cities and counties are saying, hey, you know, we're private lawyers. We put $50 million into this effort already. We did hundreds of depositions and wrenched free millions of documents from the pharmaceutical industry. We brought them to the courthouse steps and have already achieved some settlements. So we need a piece of this, too.
Right. Do the attorneys general have leverage or even authority to force the municipalities to agree to the deal?
You know, unless there's a single judge in the Northern District of Ohio sitting in Cleveland who's overseeing, you know, the vast bulk of these 2,600 lawsuits, and I couldn't sit here and tell you whether that judge would have the power to compel the other entities to enter into any kind of settlement. Certainly at this point, the cities, the counties, and their private lawyers have significant leverage too.
You mentioned how the $48 billion would be a split as far as cash versus $26 billion in addiction treatment drugs. This is not in one lump, is it, Rich?
No, this would come over 10 years. And Mr. Shapiro yesterday outlined the breakdown of at least Pennsylvania's share in the tentative deal, said that 15% of it would go to municipal coffers, 15% of it will go to the state general fund, and he said 70% of it would go into what he called an abatement fund, which would back up treatment efforts in the communities.
Mm-hmm. In just a couple of sentences, Rich, did Shapiro respond to some comments that the $48 billion might not be enough?
You know, he clearly believes that it's a significant sum. It's four times the proposed settlement with Purdue Pharma, an entirely separate proposed settlement, which he thinks is insufficient. So, yeah, he thinks that this should be enough to get the deal done. And some of the attorneys for the municipalities and indeed some individual municipalities have said, hey, we really don't think this comes close to meeting the damage that's been done by this epidemic on our streets.
Rich Lord is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Thanks, Rich.
Yeah, my pleasure, Kevin.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Some PNC customers say the bank has restricted access to third-party cash-sharing apps such as Venmo. PNC has indicated that's because it's made some security enhancements. WESA reporter Kathleen Davis has been talking to some PNC customers and representatives of the platform Plaid, which connects bank accounts to other apps. She joins us in studio now. Welcome, Kathleen.
Thanks for having me.
Kathleen, do we know how many customers have been affected?
So I don't have a specific number for you, but this does seem like a very widespread issue. If you do a simple Google search, just like PNC Venmo issues or PNC and another app issues, there are tons and tons of tweet complaints and threads on places like Reddit of people complaining about this issue and being like, I don't know what's going on. Can somebody help me? And these threads go back to May. So this has been a widespread issue for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. How many cash sharing apps are we talking about that are having issues?
Also unclear, but it does seem to be also widespread. I mean, Venmo is probably one of the most popular cash sharing apps. I mean, that's one that most people know of. So many people use Venmo. And the fact that that one is one of the ones that people are having problems with really shows that this is a problem that's affecting most cash sharing services.
So what are customers learning directly from PNC?
Sure. So I talked to a bunch of people who are PNC customers who had reached out to PNC customer service about this issue. And a lot of them said they got sort of unclear answers. So whether they were complaining about problems with Venmo or problems with other cash sharing services, most people said that they were not given a specific answer from PNC, but they were told you should check in with these other services. And in some cases, PNC customer service was telling customers that they could potentially try Zelle, which is a cash sharing app that is in a similar vein as Venmo.
Partially owned by PNC.
Yes, and Zelle is partially owned by PNC. PNC says that this is not an effort to get people to move to Zelle. But it is something that customer service is suggesting.
Right. PNC gave you a statement. What's the gist of what they said?
Sure. So they said that the reason that people are having problems is that they have these security enhancements that have gone into effect. And they say security enhancements are things that they do pretty frequently in an effort to protect their customers' data. It's unclear exactly what these security enhancements are, but it's clear that they have affected people's used to a lot of services that they use.
Mm-hmm. And there is advice on manually relinking?
Is that what
they're
doing? Sure. So the spokesperson from PNC that I spoke with said there is a fix specifically for Venmo. Not clear on the other cash sharing apps, but specifically for Venmo, they say, oh, people can manually relink their accounts from their PNC accounts to Venmo. That's a process that takes a few days, so you have to be kind of out of commission from Venmo for a little bit. But none of the people that I spoke with, none of the PNC customers that I spoke with said that they were given that advice by PNC customer service.
Debit cards still do work though, correct?
Yes, debit cards and credit cards still do work, but for a majority of cash sharing apps, there is a fee associated. So that's a problem for a lot of people.
WESA reporter Kathleen Davis, thanks so much.
Thanks, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Monday on The Confluence, our communities are more linked than ever before. Leaders must be able to connect with diverse partners across different sectors. We'll talk with the executive director of Coro Pittsburgh, which is trying to develop those leadership styles to create lasting, impactful solutions. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.